You're listening to Campus Review Radio.
Welcome to HeadX, hosted by Martin Betts. This podcast explores the changing landscape of the higher education sector. Welcome to the Higher Education Experience.
Welcome back to the HeadX podcast, everybody. And we're delighted to bring you another keynote and panel session from our recent HeadX Changing Higher Education for Good conference. This particular episode and segment contains a brilliant keynote from Michael Crowe, the president of Arizona State University, famous around the world for the contribution that he's been making over 22 years, and advancing social justice with great use of pedagogy, industry partnerships, and new approaches to technology and transforming a university to deliver on the equity ambitions that so many of us would have. We'll hear from Michael in his keynote about the recent activities of Arizona State University and the way that he sees the world and the opportunities for and the responsibilities for educational institutions to serve them. We'll then be followed with an excellent panel of variety of people from different parts of the Australian and global higher education system, addressing issues of a range of different equity challenges we face and what the priorities are in dealing with them. So let's hear straight away from Michael Crowe, the president of Arizona State University.
I'm so delighted to be joined at the start of our second session of today by President Michael Crowe, the president of Arizona State University. He's there on the stage as if by magic. He's joining us from Washington, D.C. Michael, thanks very much for joining us here in Melbourne, Australia at the HeadX conference.
Thank you, Martin. It's really great to be able to be here. I obviously didn't get the memo on the shirts. You know, I just wore the standard issue light blue shirt, so
Michael,
I didn't get the memo.
I'll take that as an invitation to bring you on to San Diego in about a month's time. Be careful what you wish for.
Yes.
And we're wishing for some real color in this next 25 minutes as we reflect with questions that I've prepared to ask you, and which I invite everyone in the audience to ask by putting them in Slido. If you go into Slido again, you'll see all those questions you asked in the first session have been cleared out. They're being saved. We might, goodness knows what we might do with them at the end of all of this. Word clouds comes to mind and all sorts of things. But we'll decide what to do. But what we'll do with any questions you pop in while I start us off asking some questions of Michael will be that those that get the most votes and seem the most relevant to where we are at that point of time, I'll try and relate to Michael as questions from us. But Michael, to start off with, I don't know how much you've been following what's been happening in Australia over the last 18 months or so. We had a change of government. We had a major national review of our higher education system initiated. We've had 16 months or more of consultation of a core panel chaired by Mary O'Kane, one of our former vice chancellors of University of Adelaide. She, with a panel and extensive consultations, has just a month or so ago published a 408-page report, 47 recommendations. It's being considered by our federal government for possible implementation over the next 25 years. We're all excited about where it's heading in a big picture of one of more equitable access to education by Australian students that we want to grow in number quite significantly over the next 25 years. But the conversation we've just had with our local leaders in the room has been along the lines of how certain we can get that ambitious policy agenda will get adopted, funded, and whether it is in the interests of the leaders of our institutions here now to, in the current circumstances, wait for those decisions to be finalised and wait for the outcomes, or to, you know, without oversimplifying it, David Lloyd, I think, of our Universities Australia group just said that perhaps it's time to just get on with it. I think I know what you would do if you were here, but can I ask you, in front of all of this group in the room and people on live stream around the world, you've now led Arizona State University for more than 20 years, coming up for 21 years, I think, or maybe I'm a year behind now.
You've 22, been, yeah.
22, I'm a one behind. And that you've been, I think, rated the most innovative university by US News and World Report for, is it 10 or is it 11 now? It's certainly a long time.
And, years, yeah.
Yeah, and you set a charter for ASU when you first got there 22 years ago, and you've been celebrating the success by recognition, but by all sorts of other things. Can you start off by telling us how much you felt it necessary at Arizona State University to be directed by or wait for policy to be settled and budgets to all be set in public sector bodies before embarking on the strategy that you've had?
Go ahead.
No, you go.
Yeah, so it really is to your colleague, you know, get on with it. And it goes something like this. I mean, at least in the United States, the standard issue public university model operating as a public agency driven heavily by public policy with large public investment in facilities and so forth and so on, that model has essentially not been successful. It doesn't scale. It doesn't adapt. It's not quick enough. It's not agile enough. So my appointment as president of ASU 22 years ago, the governing board that appointed me said, could you build something that serves the people, that is owned by the people, but operates as a private, not as a private university, but as what we call a public enterprise? Can you become agile, innovative, derive your own revenues? We make some strategic investments in you. So this year, our revenue this year will be about 7.4 billion Australian dollars, and about 600 million of those Australian dollars comes from the government, and the rest comes from something that we're doing. But more important than the revenue model is the logic model. So what we basically said is, we need to be freed from standard issue government bureaucracy because it's not adaptive enough to what we need to do in terms of building the intellectual design and the flexibility and the agility and the scalability of the institution. So we switched from sort of government control to government empowerment, from government design and government policy to measured outcomes and utility of return. And so we built a new model that we call the public enterprise university model.
That's been a hugely successful model that's been widely recognized and widely celebrated. And when you were the guest on the 50th podcast of the HeadX podcast some year or so ago now, Michael, I can remember the conversation that we had then went along the lines of what you felt that university presidents are paid to do. And I know this is something that you, at least at that time, felt very strongly about. I can only presume that you feel equally strongly about it now, that if this is a time when we could be subject to the playing out of university policy dilemmas, or this is a time when university presidents, vice chancellors could be courageous, be bold, try things out, really take initiatives, what is your view about what the role of president or vice chancellor is?
Well, I mean, it definitely is not that of warden, superintendent, or other passive bureaucratic roles. It has to be more of the role of entrepreneurial, intellectual leader, but not unilateral leader. It's not a military organization. It's not a business organization. And what I mean by that, the presidents who are in the United States very well compensated should be risk takers as a function of their compensation. They should be held to goals. They should have performance-oriented outcomes, all within, you know, sort of a public enterprise kind of modality. So one thing that's happened here is there's a phrase that I use sometimes about presidents. You know, do you want to be the president because you think it's some kind of honor, particularly at, you know, high prestige, high research universities? And therefore the job is just sort of managing the process and overseeing the process, or do you really want to do the job? And if you look at the job, at least in the United States, you know, more than half the people that have gone to college in the United States to pursue a degree didn't graduate. Equity in the system, that is the ability of a person from a lower quartile family income family to ultimately graduate from a college in the United States. That's a 10% outcome across that social grouping, which is exceedingly low. So that's another lack of success. And so we've had insufficient innovation, non-innovation models, non-leadership models, and all of those things lead to basically passivity and what I call standard issue bureaucratic theory. In bureaucratic theory, most universities become what are called conservers. They conserve their energy, they have political infighting among and between each other. They have political infighting within the institution itself. They have no unique mission. They basically begin taking on the characteristics of the post office or the motor vehicles division. And that's the worst possible model for an academic organization to take on.
Yes, the post office is an interesting comparison. I never thought about that one before. And look, you've had these views for a long period of time as you've led a completely transformed university over 22 years. But looking at what things are going on in the world right now, Michael, the current rate of change in technology, we talk about fast-changing technology all of the time, but the last 12 months or so have seen an acceleration in that. We have a greater articulation of what skills needs are in different parts of the world as opposed to the sort of knowledge-based education systems that we've had so much in the past. I don't know what the number is. I think I heard it was $1.1 trillion US of student debt in America recently. That's probably gone up since then. We similarly have high levels of student debt in Australia that are being exposed to escalation with rising inflation. We have the challenges of making higher education accessible to everyone in society. Is this, in your view, a time that's calling for even greater risk-taking and even more boldness than when you started 22 years ago?
Well, it's not greater risk-taking because now we have more tools at our hands to be more innovative, to do more things. A few years ago, we had 6,000 engineering students. We had a low freshman retention rate. We used the standard weed-out model. We decided that was wrong. We built new ways to teach math, new ways to teach chemistry, new ways to teach biology. We went from 900 engineering graduates a year to 7,100 engineering graduates a year in less than 15 years with enhanced quality, enhanced outcomes, enhanced return, more diversity than the society even represents itself, all as a function of not just taking risks. It's not about taking risks. It's about doing something other than just minding the store, doing something other than, counting the beans as they go by. And so the tools that are available now are unbelievably powerful in terms of enhancing learning outcomes. The AI tools, we have 100 AI projects underway right now. We just did a big project with OpenAI. We have major projects with Google and other companies. And we're not interested in replacing our faculty. We're not interested in having fewer faculty. We're not interested in any of that. What we're interested in is accelerating learning, deepening learning, enhancing learning outcomes, teaching across the entire spectrum of the society, all of the backgrounds, all of the types of thinkers, all of the types of learners. And so where we are right now is we're approaching an unbelievable moment where computational tools, pedagogical designs, new models for teaching on campus, new models for teaching online are enabling us to basically hugely accelerate our learning outcomes. And so, and then out of academic institutions, with people have like thumbs in their ears or whatever, they're worrying about cheating associated with AI, they're worrying about all kinds of things, all of which are real, but they're at least third level factors. They're not even principal level factors. The principal level factor is we have not built a system that allows us to take human learning for most humans into a lifelong process where they can adapt to all of the changes that we're helping to drive as a set of universities themselves, the kinds of things that we produce. And so, we're just sitting back, protecting and defending the status quo when we should be embracing these technologies. It's not about taking risks. The risk is doing nothing. The risk is ongoing underachievement. The risk is not changing. The risk is basically having a quarter of the population highly educated, another quarter of the population wanting to be educated, and half the population becoming increasingly angry because of the benefits that the educated people are getting that are outpacing everything. I mean, we right now have an unbelievable bifurcation in the American economy of incomes, of outcomes, of worker life outcomes, of lifestyles, of lifespans, all these things. And education is the number one predictor of those outcomes. And we can't figure out how to make education more broadly available because we're just too bureaucratic and too risk averse.
Okay, I think I know where you stand on that one, Michael. And I was going to ask you specifically about your partnership with OpenAI and the place of AI, but maybe I'll broaden that out. I last saw you face-to-face at the ASU GSV Summit last year, and that's look forward to seeing you in a few weeks' time with your shirt.
Yes.
Last year I was in the room with 1,500 other people while Sam Altman was being interviewed by Dan Rosenzweig, the CEO of Chegg and a board member of Adobe. Adobe are one of our sponsors here today. We'll all be there again next month for ASU GSV, and I don't know, I might do a bit of a poll in this room of hands up if you've attended ASU GSV in San Diego. You might not be able to see it, Michael, but there was about 6 or 7 hands went up in a 200-seat theater. And look, it's a not-miss for me from now on. But why don't you describe, for the benefit of those that haven't been, what ASU and GSV is, why you set it up, and how important you feel it is for a university to work with the EdTech ecosystem in leading innovation and change in a global university?
Well, so first, you know, we live in a weird, in the United States, all of our national labs are built around weapons of mass destruction or individual human health or agriculture. We have no national labs in learning. We have no national learning technology labs. There's no national learning technology lab in Australia. There's no massive amounts of investments. And so it turns out that the universities are highly innovative in their scientific fields with a few innovations in learning, but they're not particularly innovative in learning or ed tech outcomes. So 15 years ago, we started an event called ASU GSV. GSV stands for Global Silicon Valley. It's a Silicon Valley-based venture capital firm. We started it in Scottsdale, Arizona, just a couple hundred people, and we had one purpose: bring together everyone developing learning technologies or educational technologies with everybody that might ever want those or want to invest in those or want to develop those. 15 years later, last year you were there in San Diego. We moved the meeting to San Diego because we could do it in a single building where we put the 7,000 people that attended and from 80 countries. We had 16,000 people come in digitally via Zoom. And so what we've done for the 15 years from our perspective, and the reason that we did it was we wanted to do deals. We wanted to find technologies, acquire them, adapt them, modify them, partner with them. And so we've done this hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of times. We have hundreds of technologies that we've embedded in the university. Not very many universities came at the beginning. A few, many more are coming now, but universities are still, you know, absent. You know, I guess they're sitting back, you know, waiting for the moon to crater in a different direction, or the upcoming, you know, solar eclipse to not really, you know, stop, or I don't know really what they're waiting for. And so what we decided to do, so we have new advising technologies. We have new health technologies in 13 different languages, chatbots to deal with mental health issues. We have learning technologies by the hundreds. We have new ways to teach math, new ways to teach English, new ways to teach digital photography, all of which have then been embedded in with our faculty. And then we built a unit in the university to take these technologies and work with our faculty. And so our faculty now have become super faculty. So, you know, this year we'll graduate about 40,000 students. And when we started this process, we had about 8,000. The students will be completely representative of the entire socioeconomic diversity and ethnic diversity of the United States. So we have about 175,000 degree-seeking students, about half online, about half on campus. This year we'll do $1 billion of research expenditures without a medical school. Our faculty have become unbelievably productive, enhanced by these technologies in every possible way. Our mental health staff, our healthcare staff, our advising staff, all these technologies have altered everything that we do. They've altered how we operate, how we think, what our margins are, how we generate money, how we make all these things happen. And so ASU GSV for us has been that meeting, that event, and it's become a big deal. Like I said, people come there from last year. There were people there from 80 countries, hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of companies there, technologies there, investors there, users there. And for us, it has been a game changer, absolute game changer.
it was an eye-opener for me going there for the first time last year. And when I was there last year, as well as all of that tech and investment that I was expecting to find, I didn't expect to learn that you'd just got back from Rwanda, where you'd been working with the MasterCard Foundation as one of many ventures you have to democratize the global access to the transformational opportunity of education. We have a system here in Australia that's been very reliant on and very successful at onshore international students for our funding. We've relied on it to fund our research for many years now. And I wonder how, with that relentless focus on innovation, equity and technology, you'd see the landscape of and the responsibility we all have for international education with the state of the world in 2024 and what you're doing about it.
So just in India alone, there's 35 million people that we know of that want to go to college for which there's no college for them to go to. I mean, none. No online opportunity, no physical space that they can go and they want to go. All over Africa, we have projects in Rwanda, projects in Mozambique, projects in Malawi, projects in Ghana, projects in Egypt. And what's enabling us to do this is these technology platforms that we've been able to work on and our ability to project our faculty with other faculties in these other parts of the world to help create learning opportunities. And so what's happened is that, you know, those of us probably most in the room, you know, went to college. We're all fat and sassy. We're doing all right. We're doing okay. We just forget that, you know, it used to be that, you know, we needed to teach everybody how to read, and then we needed to get everybody through elementary school. Then we needed to get people through high school. And then we gave up on everybody. Because we literally think in our sector that, well, there's people that aren't, you know, they can't keep learning throughout their life. So, I mean, literally, we've blown up our entire university. We now have an academic enterprise with 20 colleges, 250 academic units, 850 degree programs, and 6,000 faculty members, and they're taking people down the normal paths in highly technological arenas. And now we're saying to ourselves, you can then do that digitally, and then that makes that then global, and that then makes that, you're able to learn in other ways. Then we have another thing that we call the learning enterprise, which is thousands of courses and hundreds of thousands of learners who are not in degree programs from all over the world. K-12 learners, high school learners, college learners, adult learners, everybody. It's all the same content modified this way or that way. And so Martin, what we're able to do is, and I think the Australian universities, which have done a fantastic job on a global basis, they're fantastic institutions. You know, this is a teeming planet of 8 billion people, you know, with an average per capita income of under $10,000 a year across the planet, with educational aspirations that are unbelievable. You got to read what people want to be or what they want to do or where they want their countries to go. And so the work that we're doing in Rwanda, the work that we're doing in Egypt, the new startup university that we're partnering with in Kyiv, Ukraine, the institutions that we've got in we have 25 institutions that we're partnering with. At a minimum right now. And so the reason I'm saying this is that what we found is that the second that you empower your faculty and lower your shields and open up your gates, educational attainment for our species is not about getting degrees. It's about the empowerment of the human brain, the human mind, human creativity at the highest level. Imagine if we had more people capable of dreaming and thinking and aspiring to whole new ways of thinking, as opposed to I grew up in a public supported housing project around the country in a working class family, working poor family. You know, I have siblings who didn't graduate from high school, who because they weren't able to get the kind of educational opportunities that I got, you know, throwing the javelin or whatever way I had to earn my way through college, you know, their lives in their 60s now are completely different lives because they didn't find a way to keep learning. So we're stuck. I mean, our system is stuck. We sit around talking about how many 18-year-olds there are and how that might affect the outcome of college going. We sit around and wonder whether or not we'll be able to attract more international students when even in Australia there are millions and millions and millions of people and in Oceania tens of millions, hundreds of millions of people who are just up the road from you guys in Malaysia or Indonesia, other places, Vietnam. Hundreds of millions of people who are wanting their lives to be enhanced through learning, and we just don't know how to do it. And it's now we have the means. We never had the means before. Now we have the means, and it's time to get with it.
Indeed. And there you go. Applause from this room and applause from Brandon Busteed, who I first met at ASU GSV last year. I'm sure you know Brandon. And he recently wrote that he thinks Arizona State University should be nominated for the Nobel Peace Prize. I'm sure you noticed that. I know that you have a mission and a purpose that's about democratizing education. You've just illustrated that only too eloquently. And that you sign up to the mission of changing higher education for good. What would you say about how we all might treat searching for prizes, for awards, for rankings, for status in our running of universities? Or are there higher order goals that we should be driven by?
Yeah, it's kind of weird. My father's family came as indentured servants from England to Maryland in the 1640s. And then they later fought in the Revolution to overthrow the British rule in the United States. And then we've been here ever since, you know, approaching 400 years. But isn't it just the weirdest thing that we ended up turning ourselves back into British institutions, where status is a function of something granted through exclusivity by who gets to attend a particular college? Well, I don't know what the Australian word is for that, but that's crap. And so what I mean by that is we have to have university recognition for social transformation, we have to have university recognition for economic success across the broadest spectrum of the population. We have to have universities that are measured on what they do versus who they admit only. And so I'm being very stark in this, but I think what Brandon was talking about was, you know, how about having some breakout universities, you know, as the title of this meeting, Changing Higher Education for Good. It's not that what we have isn't good. It's not that we haven't made great progress, although, you know, the polar ice caps are melting and the thermal halings cycle in the Atlantic Ocean might change, and, you know, then we're all going to go to hell in a handbasket here. But notwithstanding that, and we did that, by the way, ourselves, our university geniuses helped contribute to all that. We don't have universities that are focused on the broader social outcomes. We have universities that are obsessed with status. One of the reasons that we decided to become a mega research university at $1 billion a year of research expenditures without a medical school, while then taking on the broadest student body possible and growing the student body to every qualified student, was so that we could just tell everyone else to go to hell. And so what I mean by that is we could just tell everybody else, you know, listen, our faculty are as good as your faculty. We're just doing a different mission. Our mission isn't how few can we admit and how great they are when we then ultimately graduate them. The notion is, at least for our university, is how can we build an institution which is truly democratic, truly egalitarian, and truly focused on the success of the democracy itself. So that's really what we're working on.
It's great work, Michael, and we're really pleased that you've been able to join us from Washington, D.C. tonight and share that message with the HEDX conference here in Melbourne. Please, everyone, join me in thanking Michael Kerr.
Happy to do it.
I'll see you in San Diego with that shirt, Michael.
Thank you.
Well, that was a really spectacular presentation by Michael Crow. And that's setting up the panel session that we have on equity issues that we'll have a chance to now plug into, inspired by those words from Michael. And we'll be hearing from the leader of that panel session straight after this word from our sponsors.
Short on resources to enhance your university's online learning objectives? OES's collaborative approach ensures program success while offering flexibility across disciplines. Our tailored solutions uphold academic rigour and your reputation. Choose OES for adaptable, high-quality online learning experiences.
We will now be joined by the leader and facilitator of our next panel, who is Paul Harper, accompanied by James in front and Sean to his side. Thank you, Sean, for shaking your head on cue. And I'll leave Paul. We're running a little bit behind time, Paul, but you run your full half an hour, please, my friend, and I'll find out something to do with the rest of the afternoon. and I'll let you introduce the fine people that are joining you on stage. Please make them all feel welcome.
Thank you. That's a bit loud. Well, we are loud. We're going to be loud up here, so let's do it. Thank you, Martin. And I'll start by let everyone introduce themselves. And you heard that I'm Paul, but I might actually go down to the other end and come back up to me so I introduce myself last. And so who wants to go down there?
We're on the other side of you.
Oh, you're on the other side. Well, down that side, see. Hello, everyone. Anyway. We didn't quite get that part of the dance card right. Have you ever seen my dance? Oh, my God, it's so bad. That just personifies it. So throw it down to the right end.
Yeah, I'm Mohammed. I'm a student at the University of Melbourne. I'm a Master's of Chemical Engineering student, and I was the People of Colour Officer at the University of Melbourne Student Union last year.
I'm Kate Gilpin. I work for Welcoming Australia as the Coordinator of Welcoming Universities.
My name is Joel DiTrapani, and I'm one of the co-founders and the CEO of Vigo.
That was quick. I'm obviously the age balance on the panel. I'm Marcia Devlin. I'm the CEO of the Victorian Academy of Teaching and Leadership. I now don't work in the university sector, but did for over 30 years until very recently.
G'day, I'm Paul. I do a bunch of stuff. I'm a professor at the University of Queensland Law School. I'm affiliated with the Harvard Project on disability, and chair Universities Enable, which is a disability steering group for the sector, and do a bunch of other stuff. But what I want to flip to is, like, I'm just thrilled to be here on stage today talking about diversity with such thought leaders. In this session, we are looking to change higher education for the good and achieve the full range of equity, diversity, inclusion goals. So today, we're going to explore workable solutions which can open the opportunities of opportunity of universities to all people. And when I say all, by the way, I mean all. And I mean we must include the marginalised majority. And I refer to the marginalised majority as all of those who are from marginalised groups. And they're marginalised in society and from our higher education sector in many cases. And when you look around here at this group on stage, if you think about what percentages of the population we represent in our society and in our higher education, we aren't the minority. We are the majority. We just aren't the majority in the halls of power, or aren't the majority who are benefiting from higher education in society. Now, I believe we can change that. I believe universities are the machine through which we can create a more inclusive society. And to see how we're going to do that, I want to turn to our panel of amazing experts. So, no pressure there. But, Marcia, I might flick it to you first. So, some of your more recent research has focused on supporting lower SES students. Can you comment on any policy responses which support lower SES students, and also considering the higher costs for universities associated with such supports?
Thanks, Paul. Yeah, absolutely. So one of the most recent studies I did with colleagues from across the sector, and also ACER, Australian Council for Educational Research, and we looked at the costs of supporting low SES students compared to the costs of supporting other students. We found that supporting low SES students costs between four times more for postgraduate students and six times more for undergraduate students. I won't read out the figures because they're quite alarming, but four to six times more. And the reasons, the three main reasons that the costs are so much higher are the following. The first is the costs of increasing or changing aspiration and capital prior to universities. So a lot of universities, particularly the ones I worked in the later part of my career, regional universities, universities that focus on low SES areas, such as Victoria University, where I'm still an adjunct, will do a lot of work in aspiration building and capital building among the communities that they're there to serve. And it costs a lot of money. from going out to outreach to communities and to school. They start sometimes in early childhood, sometimes in primary school, and up those efforts through high school to make students aware of the opportunities through university and actually build the academic and other skills that they need to succeed. So that's one of the three main reasons for the cost drivers. The second is the cost of multiple campuses. And many regional universities have many campuses and they all cost a lot of money. There's fixed costs, there's variable costs. And the third one is the cost of supporting the highly complex needs of some of the students on some of those campuses, particularly if they're in highly disadvantaged areas. So a lot of reasons. There's more nuance in the report and the research, but they're the sort of high level. And so some of the policy responses we came up with, I was really pleased to see reflected in some of the recommendations from the Accord. And I'll just pick out three in particular. One being around the concentration and distribution of funding. Recommendation 13 from the Accord addresses this, which was just wonderful to see. And that is, as you all know, because you've all studied the Accord document and can learn all, 53 recommendations off by heart. Adopt a needs-based funding model, including a per-student funding amount for underrepresented students that recognises the cost of additional support to succeed. I think whoever wrote that had read the research report that we put out, which was great. So that's one, concentration and distribution of funding, so that it's actually put where it's needed to support students. It's quite controversial in some ways, so it's not a per-student funding, it's a per-needs of the student funding arrangement. The second policy recommendation we came up with was activity-based funding moving to mission-based costing. So it was found in our study that universities that are small, universities that have missions to address disadvantage, universities that have multiple campuses and or campuses located in disadvantaged areas all have larger costs in supporting low SES students. I'm not sure whether Recommendation 13 addresses that, because the second part of that recommendation is giving a completion bonus for higher education providers who meet agreed completion targets. I'm a little bit worried about that having perverse incentives for universities or higher education providers, but we can see. And the third one, I think, is the most controversial policy position we put out, was applying the principles of cost compensation. And what we mean by that is that given the cost of supporting low SES students are 4 to 6 times higher, strictly applied, Recommendation 13 would mean each low SES student would attract 4 times, if they're a postgraduate, or 6 times more funding than a non-low SES student. There would be the need for further analysis and nuance, of course, but we thought those fiscal equalisation principles, I don't really know what that means, but I worked with some very clever economists who told me that's what I needed to write as lead author, would need to be applied. Thank you.
Thank you. Well, let's stay with supporting students. So, Joel, what has VIGO's experience been in supporting universities and students over the last few months? As we know, the University's Accord interim report, he's called for some changes and they're already in place. So for VIGO's perspective, are there particular aspects or the student support package, support for students policy, sorry, or in the University's Accord, the final report, that you feel are particularly well suited to digital solutions that you guys might offer?
Yeah, great question, because it's well suited to me, so thank you. But I first of all, don't expect that level of answer. That was amazing. Yeah, I don't have any notes here. But look, to be honest, we love the support for students policy. I love to see, you know, we heard so much today about, like, let's talk in more doing, and the government moved very quickly. You know, the interim report came out, and then pretty quickly the support for students came out. So across the board, though, we've dealt with nearly every institution in the country at this point as they prepare for the support for students policy. And the responses has been kind of mixed. We're both deeply inspired and disappointed by the kind of mixed responses across the industry. In some spaces, we're seeing universities kind of use this moment as a catalyst for work they've been wanting to do for years. And we're seeing people very excited, just deep investments in completely reshaping how they think about student support, how they think about their student support ecosystem, the operations that they need there. And we're loving seeing that. And then, you know, on the inverse, you know, there are some universities out there who are just kind of shutting their eyes and hoping that this will go away. But in general, I think the support for students policy really is encouraging universities and telling them that they're going to need a digital adoption platform here. There's going to need to be some kind of platform to make this possible. Because with this new remit coming down and so much emphasis being on supporting students across the board, being proactive, being personalized, and supporting all students, not just, you know, the easy students to support, the students who are putting their hand up, is that this is going to be expensive. So if we want to support students in the way that we are doing it now, which is knocking on doors, sending out emails, having phone calls through spreadsheets, that is not a scalable way to do this. So absolutely, I think, you know, the some kind of digital platform, whether that's a custom-built platform or, you know, very expensive Salesforce systems, there's going to need to be further investment from a digital side to set this up. But I think technology agnostic is that there's going to need to be massive investments, at least, you know, structurally in the operations side of things. So we've been working very hard with a lot of our partners and a lot of institutions across the country to release a new framework called the Support Ecosystem Maturity Evaluation Curve, or SEMIC as we just call it internally, which is just, you know, every university is on a different journey. Every university has gone through a different amount of steps that they're taking to support their students. Every university already knows that support services are the way that they can help all of their students, every student differently. But every university hasn't taken the same amount of steps. So we're developing this framework. We're working with people to help them understand where are they now and where do they need to go. So I think, you know, what is encouraging, though, is that when you take technology out of it, universities seem very interested to at least trying to understand where they're at this point in time. And so, yeah, I guess one of the big things that we're doing right now is just helping universities understand what the best next steps are for them.
Thanks, Len. Just plugging my university. Which university did that come out of again?
Yeah, we did come out of UQ, so I do have a second football here.
Huzzah.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Going back, so supporting students and staff in these groups often requires changing cultures. And we hear this a lot. Discrimination equities are often normalised and they are accepted. And you see this all the time. So on the challenges on changing university culture, I want to direct a question down to Cade and Mohammed. So in the University's Accord final report, you'll see in there, in the Tertiary Education Commission, they call for a study that should focus on the prevalence and impact of racism across the tertiary education sector. So I want to, Mohammed, from a student perspective, and Kate from someone who is supporting the university network to combat or to make it more welcoming for everyone, how do you think studies like the one proposed in the Accord can make a difference? And I suppose thinking what David said, it's time just to get on with it. Should we wait for the tech to be set up and wait for the tech to do the study? Should we just do it and make the changes we need? You can pick.
I will let Mohammed speak first. I think that's important from the student perspective and from someone who's done some research in this space.
Yeah. So to just answer your question, thank you for that question. I want to look at like a couple of case studies that do that research into racism on a university level, one of which is my university, University of Melbourne, and the Australian National University. Their student associations have conducted research into racism on a university level, and the results of that were quite shocking. I wrote the Racism at UniMelb report, the first edition, and since then we've published 3 editions annually. So the latest one is the 3rd edition of Racism at the University of Melbourne report. And look, it's the reports that students have submitted into this were, you know, were nothing short of slurs, physical harassment, othering, stereotyping, and that's just beginning to scratch the surface of what racism in higher education looks like. They've also reported barriers to reporting racism, like why they feel that the university does not provide that space for them to speak on such a damaging and important issue on campus. And they also reported subject contents being not culturally inclusive and not having any sort of, you know, not providing that global education that the University of Melbourne claims to provide. And I brought the report just for a bit of show and tell, and you can see that it's a book. Like, we've had 855 students responding to my survey of racism on campus, and that just goes to show that this isn't an issue that, you know, is recent, or this isn't an issue that is well spoken about. You know, it's ignored. You know, it's really underreported, not really spoken about. And it took me a lot of effort to connect with students to get them to trust me into speaking up and recording their experiences for the whole world to see. The issues with this whole process were how the university kind of handled it. We've been really pretty much ignored for 3 years until we caused enough ruckus that the university had to listen to us, and they finally started taking some action and implementing the 14 recommendations that I've brought with the report. So I think that the university accords process of, you know, doing research into this might help tackle the issue in the sense that it will, you know, it will kind of be an overarching body or overarching survey that focuses on racism in the entire country. You know, there are student representatives in other parts of the country that, you know, don't really speak about this issue, but it doesn't mean that it doesn't exist. It's just not spoken about. And so I really see it as a step. It's an initial step, but the issues that come into my mind immediately is that, are there going to be concrete actions with this? And it's, you know, the first thing that came out of this report, because I thought that, look, if I come to the University of Melbourne with, you know, hard proof, quote unquote, you know, statistics, experiences and whatnot, that they're going to listen to me, right? You know, that makes sense. You know, I'm speaking the university's language. I'm giving them what they need. But I was faced with the reality that that's not it. You know, like, it's not enough that a student is bringing about these issues. And so I think going above universities' heads and kind of framing it as a national issue will be quite significant in tackling this issue over the long term. But again, like, my questions about, you know, this recommendation is, for example, is it going to feed into the national anti-racism framework that's developed by the Australian Human Rights Commission? You know, is it going to be something that comes with concrete actions, and what type of concrete actions? You know, is it going to have students' best interests first, or is it going to have universities' best interests first, which is, you know, a wider topic of discussion there. So, yeah, that's kind of like what our view about the whole process. But, you know, again, like, this survey should have been done yesterday. Like, we are actually really, really late in the game. And it's, you know, about time to kind of get on with it. So, yeah.
And I think that kind of speaks to what David was saying earlier. Do we just get on with it? And people are already getting on with it. Mm-hmm. It's just that that's not being listened to en masse. And I think that's the major, major stumbling block here. And I was thinking about it this morning because I was very nervous about today. And I think the big issue here is, I think this definitely needs to happen. And like Mohammed said, it needs to have happened yesterday. We just need to get on with this. We know collectively that racism exists, systemic racism, and, you know, individual racism as well within the higher education sector. But it's also, it's not just up to people who are living this and who have lived this to be the ones to speak about it all the time. And I really am so grateful to Mohammed and to his colleague Heba, who's here as well, for their constant conversations with me about this, because I am a white woman from a middle-class family who had every benefit of education, and this has been hugely eye-opening for me, and it should be eye-opening for all of us. And we have a collective responsibility to offer education to everybody from all backgrounds. And to me, inclusion breeds inclusion. So we start this conversation and we start the work on it straight away, and then that opens the doors for more and more people. Yeah, and I agree. We can't wait. It just has to happen as soon as possible, really.
Totally agree. We need action now. And don't just rely on those who have experienced the adversity. I see this in the disability space where 1 in 10 students have a disability, huge number of staff, yet those staff with disabilities who do come together and collectivise and do offer solutions don't get that factored into their workload policies, don't get... And if you're a professional staff, you may be asked to volunteer your own time outside work hours, which... As an employment lawyer, that's problematic in itself, but we won't talk about that. But this idea that they have to volunteer your time, and we do offer solutions, but I think resourcing, that's really important. And when you think about your 1 in 10 staff, you have a huge percentage of your staff who are experts, who have all these attributes. What about utilising that and creating solutions? Don't just go to a pilot and then 3 months later, after the pilot's been rolled out, get rolled back. This is something lasting. Now, on staff, I want to go back to Marsha. Now, some newly released data on Australia's workplace gender agency show that the traditional male employee earns 8.3% more than his typical female colleague. Now, if we're talking about the gender pay gap or the Indigenous pay gap, the lack of people with disabilities in the professoriate or the chancellery, of course. Now, realising equity, diversity, inclusion has been a challenge. So, not a small question. What could we do better as a sector? No, as you're a former DVC.
Yeah, I have written the answers.
Well, you've written a fantastic book.
Thank you. Great question.
Beating the odds, by the way.
I missed that question until this morning, so I haven't had time to think about
it. Well, just tell us about beating the odds, because I love the support squad.
It's free outside. There's beating the odds copies. Martin wants to get rid of them because he's got to fly to Belfast and he doesn't want to take them with him. Please take a book on the way.
No, seriously.
I'm happy to sign it for you.
Read the chapter on support squad. I directed a bunch of students to it last night. It's really, really important.
Thank you. So I was going to say, what can the sector do about it? And just taking on board what Kate and Mohammed just referred to there with don't expect the people who are experiencing things to be the ones that speak up all the time. At the same time, I absolutely agree with you. I wrote a book about sexism because I've suffered it my whole career. But at the same time, I realised writing the book, we're always waiting for someone else to do something. We're waiting for the university to take action. But we are the university. There is no... It's an inanimate object. There is no, it doesn't exist outside of us. And part of the book was to help people, women mainly, but lots of men, Paul, Martin, others have read it, and have helped, is to understand the power that you have as an individual. Everybody in the sector did something. And they do. As you said, Kate, people are doing things. But I think we could all do more and we could all realise the power that we have. There is no other... People used to come to me all the time when I was a DVC and say, the university needs to do this and the university needs to do that and the university needs to do the other. And I go, well, who are you talking about? You are the university. I am the university. I can't do what you just said on my own. How can we work together? What can we do? And then there'd be a time-limited working party and then there'd be a committee and, usual university and I'd have to go to academic board for approval, yada, 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 yada. And then 8 months later, we'd do something. In the meantime, we'd start doing something and we'd start building a coalition and we'd start building a community of practice and inspiring each other and supporting each other. And Paul's right, the support squad's really important. No one can do this on their own. There are more and more people listening to this conversation. There are more and more people joining this conversation. Kate's absolutely right. What's the point if we're not inclusive? What we're doing is, helping the children of the elite to remain elite if we're not just opening it up to everybody. And we all choose to work in education and we don't choose to work in it for the money. God knows if you're a woman or a woman with a disability or an Aboriginal woman, you don't choose to work for the money. We do it because we think we can change the world. We can change higher education for good. So I think my call to action to people here today who've taken the time out of their day, the emails are piling up while you're here, you're going to go back and you're going to pay for having done this. Thank you for coming. Thank you for listening. Go back, inspire yourself, inspire other people. We are the sector. There is no other set of people, right? So I guess that's my answer, having not thought about it for very long.
Thank you, but I do... I'd clap it on the microphone, so probably drop it. I want to say one thing. Don't wait for another report, because if you read the Disability Royal Commission, and it's only 2.5 million words, so perhaps I'll direct you and say you don't have to read the whole thing. It talks in there about co-design, and co-design doesn't mean have a person with a disability on your committee. It doesn't mean just have someone rock up at the last minute to rubber stamp it and look pretty on the poster. It means share power, resource, and resource people with disabilities to be leaders. And admittedly, that's part of my work, so it's got to be right, right? But seriously, it means co-design does mean empower people. That means resource them. It means actually have them and share the power. And we don't need another report on it. We have the answer. So let's get up, let's do it, and let's change society for the better and use universities as that machine which can open doors of opportunity to everyone. So we will benefit from the great thing, which is higher education.
Yeah, I guess the first thing that jumps out to me out of the comments and questions in the crowd is every time that universities are taking on technologies now is that you can make an active choice to make sure all of these technologies are WCAG compliant. So there are, I guess, you know, startups who are on that journey, but I would just make sure no matter when you are taking on new technologies, if they're not WCAG compliant, make sure absolutely that you're taking on technologies with a pathway to WCAG compliance. So when we are talking about, you know, the support for students policy, a big thing for us in this SEMIC framework that we're coming up is that to have a mature support ecosystem, it is key that the way you are offering support to your students needs to be accessible. So it's a huge focus for us. We have been trying to do a lot of studies or, I guess, collaborations with different universities as well to make sure we are helping students with disabilities. I am by no means an expert on this, but I'm making sure that, you know, we're bringing the right team in, we're working with the right universities and the right experts to make sure we are designing down that path as well. And it's something that I don't have experience with, so I can't make those decisions. So I love the idea of co-design, bringing those people into your fold, into your support squad, to make sure that when you have a platform, when you're onboarding a platform, make sure you have platforms that are actively caring about that as well, especially in the support space. But even when you're implementing this as well, the implementation of these things really needs to be co-designed as well. So we have the platform. We love our platform, obviously. But getting that out to students should be a co-designed implementation too, and we take that very seriously as well.
I was just going to say, I think it's a thing in the cultural diversity and inclusion space too, where people are brought in at the last minute, like you're talking about, Paul. So we want your lens on this. We don't want your opinions, your insights, your lived and living experience throughout the whole process. We just want you to tick it at the end or say, add these few words and that'll be okay. I don't want to speak for you, but that's my perception of it.
Yeah, no, that's kind of exactly what happened. So I wrote the first report and then I handed it to Hiba, who's in the audience as well, to take off after the work, you know, to work with the university and actually implement an ideal co-design situation, you know, doing it together, having a student face running it as well. But that didn't happen. It's happening now, a few years, a bit too late. But again, like, it's like, In terms of anti-racism, it does more harm than good when you implement things not in a right way. It will harm a lot more students on campus when you don't have adequate measures in place or you don't have actual student opinions into them or having them in a, quite frankly, tokenistic or performative way. It's something that, you know, whoever is trying to take up this work needs to keep in mind that, you know,
yeah, and not just current students either. Mm. Future students, potential students, communities that you engage with. It's a collective thing. It can't just be, we're nice when you get here. It's got to be a whole of sector approach. Yeah. Yeah.
And also I'd go to the former students, because I'm a former student with a disability. I know what it's like. I've experienced crap. Sorry the language, but, you know, we've experienced it. And one of the things I often hear about universities, the hearts and minds of universities are the people within it and the people in our communities. And if we are the third largest export sector in Australia, the richest sector that doesn't dig anything out of the ground, we're not, and we always say we don't have money for diversity, but the majority of people in our universities have a diversity. So I think sometimes we need to think about if diversity should be everyone's business, not just the business of an office, which is strategically designed to operationalise it across the whole university.
Yeah, exactly.
I might say, use that as a point in time when we've run out of time to ask one question that's come up in Slido that various members of the panel might want to address, Paul, and then bring this session to a close. I'm a bit reluctant to ask this question, not that I want to filter them in any way, because I can see that there's two sides to this one. I know this is a subject that Marcia's looked at in her book. The question points to
diversity and inclusion being an everywhere issue, not just in our universities, and that it's not exclusive to the education sector, and isn't it humans being different and having diverse opinions, and that it needs to start at home. I'm reluctant to ask that because I think that's right. I think it is right that we need to live the values that we live in our homes and bring them to our places of work and other places where we act. But I'm also reluctant and loath to mention it because I fear we use it as a cop-out. I fear we allow our practices of continuing to be racist, to be discriminatory against too many groups by blaming the problem on society's problem and not taking our own responsibility for it.
Can I
discuss.
Say something, Chair of Panel? Because, can I say something? I've already started.
I'm not stopping you.
Higher education, right? If there's any group or industry in the country who's going to do something about it, if it's not us, who's it going to be, right?
Yeah.
Okay, higher education. We are arguably the smartest, most well-resourced, with the highest cultural capital, sociocultural capital group of people in the country and in the world, in fact. If we don't take leadership on this, there's something wrong. So, yes, of course, it all starts at home. But not everybody has the same resources. Not everybody's born into the same families. Not everybody's born into the same cultural and sociocultural capital. But we have the power and the resources and the intellect and the responsibility, I think, to lead this. We can't ask the mining industry to do it. We can't ask, you know, not to insult that industry, but you talked about digging things out of the ground before, which reminded me. They bring a lot of money into the country. Great, right? But we are the intellectual leaders of the country, so we should do something. We should do things, and all of us, not wait for the university to do it.
Well, what a fabulous panel, and what a lovely note to finish on from Marcia. And that was an episode that started with the inspiration of Michael Crowe, who's made such a difference from his part of the world in democratising higher education and addressing some equity and diversity and inclusion goals in a very direct way. And a range then that followed of a panel of Australian and other global leaders thinking about the different issues and dimensions of that. That's really an episode of the HEDX podcast that drives at the heart of the mission of HEDX. Delighted to bring that to our audience. And that's all that we've got time for this week on HEDX.